sure that it was the missing aircraft, and there was no indication of survivors.
A helicopter pilot locates the plane that had been missing in Katmai National Park. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 29th of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the federal government considers increasing protections for the 1002 area in Anwar.
This would be the first time that the coastal plain has been analyzed for wilderness characteristics.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
Debris from a float plane missing for more than a month has been found, washed up on a beach in Katmai National Park and Preserve. From Dillingham, KDLG's Adam Kane has the story.
Katmai National Park officials were notified last night by local helicopter pilot Sam Egli, who had spotted parts of the aircraft on a narrow stretch of beach between Cape Douglas and the Douglas River. According to National Park Service spokesman John Quinley, Egli had been flying over the area for an unrelated job when he spotted the debris and flew lower to investigate.
It was wreckage from our missing aircraft, the Beaver, which had three Park Service employees and pilot on board. He was able to identify, relatively small pieces, and one piece, though, was the tail and had aircraft identification numbers and was the appropriate color. So we're sure that it was the missing aircraft, and there was no indication of survivors.
National Park Service and military personnel traveled to the site this morning to secure the debris and continue to search for additional wreckage. On August 21st, the float plane had taken off from Swickshock Lagoon, which is about 30 miles to the south of where the debris was located. Park Service maintenance workers had been working on a cabin in the area. The Beaver float plane was carrying three National Park Service employees, 26-year-old Mason McLeod, and brothers 28-year-old Neil Spradlin and 20-year-old Seth Spradlin, as well as the pilot, 47-year-old Marco Aletto from King Salmon. The discovery of the debris brings with it some closure after searchers have been scouring the land and the coast in and around Katmai National Park by air and by land for more than a month. National Park Service, Coast Guard, and civilian pilots flew more than a dozen aircraft over 60,000 square miles over the 4-million-acre national park while searching for the missing plane. Quinley says that the area where the debris was spotted had been flown over many times by Park Service personnel, and park rangers had even flown over and walked the beach within a few miles of the debris earlier this week.
The debris was in an area that I would say was in the high probability area for the search, which started back in 21st of August. We have flown over that area many, many times. Most recently, Monday, a Park Service flight was out for about 4 hours flying around the Douglas Headlands and near Kamishak Bay, and we, in fact, landed about 3 or 4 miles to the northwest and walked some of the beach. It was a perfect day for searching, bright and sunny, and we saw nothing on that beach.
It is believed that high tides and strong eastern winds on Monday and Tuesday were responsible for washing the debris up on shore and making it more visible. There had been a reward offered by the families of the missing passengers to anyone who found the plane. Quinley wasn't sure if Egli will be able to collect that reward or not. The National Transportation Safety Board will be investigating the crash. In Dillingham, I'm Adam Kane.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is considering recommending designating the entire Arctic National Wildlife Refuge as a wilderness area. Right now, three sections of the refuge are not considered wilderness areas, including the coastal plain that contains an estimated 11 billion barrels of recoverable oil. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
The decision to review the wilderness designations came out of the initial phase of completing the first conservation plan for the refuge since 1988. U.S. Fish and Wildlife spokesman Bruce Wood says the process drew a lot of comments from the public.
Since there was considerable interest in the issue, it seemed that an analysis of those wilderness characteristics would be an appropriate step.
Each of the three sections that are not currently wilderness areas will be evaluated independently, but most of the attention will be on the 1002 area, or coastal plain, which has been at the center of a decades-long battle over whether it should be open to oil drilling. Wood says the area hasn't gone through a wilderness review since the refuge was created 5 decades ago.
Yeah, I think this would be the first time that the coastal plain has been analyzed for wilderness characteristics since the refuge was established.
Wood says the decision will depend on whether the wilderness designation would be more appropriate to meet the intended purpose of the refuge. That purpose includes preserving unique wildlife, wilderness, and recreational areas, and providing for subsistence use. The Regional Fish and Wildlife Office will make the initial recommendation on any new wilderness areas for the refuge, but Woods emphasizes that decision would have to be approved by the Interior Secretary, the President, and finally, Congress.
This is early days in what looks to be a fairly long process, and the service doesn't itself have the authority to designate any of these areas as wilderness.
And Wood says even if the coastal plain does become a designated wilderness, oil drilling isn't necessarily off the table. He says Congress could still allow it.
I suppose it would make it harder because Congress hasn't very often, as far as I know, decided to allow oil and gas development within a wilderness area, and they might have to remove that wilderness designation. But it would be in the hands of Congress as it is now.
Wood says anything having to do with ANWR generates a lot of controversy, and the decision to conduct the wilderness review is no exception. Environmental groups like the Wilderness Society weighed in, saying a wilderness designation is especially important as the refuge celebrates its 50th anniversary this year. But Governor Sean Parnell said, quote, "Alaska will not allow the federal government to lock up more land without a fight." Meanwhile, three Democratic U.S. senators are trying to drum up support from their colleagues for asking President Obama to extend the strongest possible protections to ANWR. Alaska Senator Mark Begich is fighting that effort, saying prohibiting development in the coastal plain is irresponsible given the energy needs of the country. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
National Park Service boat safety checks conducted in the Yukon-Charley Rivers National Preserve between Eagle and Circle in recent weeks have resulted in conflicts. One man has been charged with disorderly conduct and other offenses, while charges are possible in a second case. Yukon-Charley Preserve Superintendent Greg Dudgeon says the agency conducts river patrols during hunting season to enforce laws and be proactive.
We're out there to be a course of help and assistance when needed and make sure that that the hunting fishing regulations, as well as some basic Coast Guard safety regulations, are being followed.
Dudgeon says that includes proper licenses and boat registrations. Yukon River resident Wayne Hall says in one of the recent incidents, longtime local Tim Henry was handcuffed by rangers after refusing to cooperate about an unregistered boat. Hall, who lives off the grid without a phone, says relations between locals and the Park Service are the worst he's seen in 18 years on the river. John Sturgeon in Anchorage, who's hunted in the Yukon-Charley area for 40 years, says law enforcement has always been a sore issue.
It's more big brother every time you go up there. Every year I go up there, there's more and more inspections. And I think these two guys that were kind of quote-unquote roughed up by the Park Service both did not think that the Park Service had authority on navigable waterways because they were actually standing on and were on state-owned property. And that's kind of one of the big rubs, and it kind of complicates this issue and makes this one a little more unique than other places in Alaska.
Sturgeon says he'd like to pursue a court case challenging the Park Service jurisdiction, but has deferred to the state, which is pursuing administrative appeals. The Yukon is one of many navigable waterways in Alaska that the state was granted management over when it was admitted to the Union, but is still working to assert that right. Park Service spokesman John Quinley says the agency has jurisdiction to conduct law enforcement.
There are a couple of regulations that apply both in 36 CFR, the Code of Federal Regulations. One allows us, gives us jurisdiction on waters within the boundaries, inside the boundaries of a National Park Service unit. And the other, specifically for waters, allows us to stop and board vessels to examine their paperwork, licensing, that sort of thing, and also to inspect for required safety gear.
Quinley says river patrols are also on the lookout for hunting and fishing violations. The Yukon Charlie Preserve's Dudgeon says the agency has made about 60 contacts with river travelers in the last few weeks, most of them without any trouble, but he acknowledges resentment of the Park Service.
Yukon Charlie National Preserve was established back in 1980, and there have been folks living on and along and in that vicinity for decades, in some cases generations before that. And so like all parks in Alaska, we have a real sensitivity to the fact that, that people on the landscape is a part of what these parks are about.
Dudgeon says that has to be balanced with the Park Service's mandates to protect resources and manage the preserve for all people. The regulations and enforcement that came with creation of the Yukon Charlie Preserve effectively forced out people who moved to the region to live off the land in the 1960s and 70s. Eagle resident Ann Millard counts only four families who still live remotely on the river within the preserve. She says the latest law enforcement cases have revived hard feelings.
I think that's the saddest part, is I know that the folks who live in town and work for the Park Service have tried very hard to rebuild that relationship and that trust, and this just has rekindled all those hard feelings and reduced the level of trust in the Park Service to do the right thing by the people who are in holders.
Millard says some locals still blame the Park Service for the death of famed river dweller Dick Cook. Cook died when his boat capsized while traveling to Eagle for a meeting with the Park Service in 2001. Fairbanks writer Dan O'Neill documented the exodus of river residents in his 2007 book, A Land Gone Lonesome. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the move toward offering wireless service on planes and ferries.
We're just trying to move as quickly as we can with it because, you know, we do know that the customers really like having their laptops.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Republican and Tea Party candidate Joe Miller could face a $50,000 fine for violating U.S. Senate ethics rules. Miller, who is running for the U.S. Senate against Democrat Scott McAdams and write-in candidate incumbent Lisa Murkowski, has been accused of failing to file required financial disclosure information. McAdams and Murkowski filed their disclosure statements within 30 days of announcing their candidacy as required. Miller formally opened his campaign on April 27th. Incomplete financial disclosure forms led to criminal charges against former Senator Ted Stevens 2 years ago. He was prosecuted for omitting $250,000 in gifts. Stevens was convicted for failing to disclose them, but the case was later thrown out because prosecutors didn't pass along crucial information to his lawyers. Calls to Miller's office by APRN today to find out if the error has been corrected were not returned by Miller or his staff. However, the Anchorage Daily News reported late this afternoon that Miller's spokesman Randy DeSoto emailed ADN staff saying the failure to file was a simple oversight, and they are working on it now. Miller is in Washington, D.C. this week for several fundraising events and to meet with incumbent senators from other states. Alaska's governor was in Washington, D.C. for a couple of days this week to represent the state at the burial of former Senator Ted Stevens. Governor Sean Parnell says despite knowing Stevens for many years and following his career, he was newly impressed by the breadth of the former senator's legacy.
We heard some about his key role in the U.S. Olympic Committee and making sure that our Olympic athletes can compete worldwide. We heard about his role in ending discrimination against women and girls in sports. So, you know, we tend to hear about the resource and infrastructure type projects that the senator worked on. We don't hear as much about his reach across this nation and world.
But Stevens was best known as an appropriator, someone who brought money home to Alaska. Parnell says the height of getting federal funds may be over, but Alaska still needs money for infrastructure projects since it is, in his words, underdeveloped compared to other states.
I think the loss of Senator Stevens' seniority alone is enough to diminish dollars coming to the state. On the other hand, I think Alaskans are ready to stand up and manage our own resources, utilize those resources to create a growing economy.
Given this, giving the state more control over resources from the feds is a common pitch point right now for candidates seeking office in November. Parnell, who's running for re-election, and others say if Alaska had more independence, it could make its own financial decisions. But Alaska's members of Congress have already been fighting that battle for years. Parnell says what's changed is that he thinks the federal government is encroaching more in Alaska than ever before. The governor says Washington has some hard choices to make in the years ahead about its priorities.
What are our constitutional mandates? Fund those first, and beyond that, you know, they're going to have to rein in spending. So I think changes are coming. I think they're coming to Washington. They're certainly coming to Alaska.
The big events in Washington and Alaska honoring Ted Stevens are over now, but Parnell has issued a proclamation declaring the former senator's birthday, November 18th, as Ted Stevens Day. On Monday, the U.S. Senate voted to name a mountain and part of an ice field in Alaska after Stevens. The mountain, known as South Hunter Peak, is in Denali National Park, south of Mount McKinley. It's the tallest unnamed peak in Alaska at 13,895 feet. The legislation now goes to the U.S. House. Alaska Airlines will extend wireless internet service to most in-state routes by the end of the year, but there will be gaps. The Alaska Marine Highway System also plans to offer onboard online service, but it's unclear when it will be available to the public. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Alaska Airlines already has Wi-Fi service on most of its flights linking lower 48 destinations. And while the equipment is installed on some planes serving the 49th state, the delivery system is not in place.
Our service provider, Aircell, is working to deploy 6 different towers within the state of Alaska that will provide Wi-Fi service on a great majority of Alaska Airlines flights.
Chase Craig is product development manager for the Seattle-based airline.
And all of them are on schedule to turn on by the end of the year. The hope is that the first two between Anchorage and Fairbanks actually turn on a little earlier.
The other towers are being installed near Cordova, Yakutat, Juneau, and Cake. Close to 3/4 of Alaska Airlines' fleet has the equipment needed for Wi-Fi service, which it calls GoGo in-flight internet. Craig says the rest will be set up by late December or early January. The system will cover flights through Southeast and those along the rail belt, but customers will find a large gap over British Columbia.
There will be a hole for some period of time. Our guesstimate is anywhere between an hour to an hour and a half of flight time in between Seattle and that first tower in the lower Southeast area.
Aircell, the system's contractor, is trying to get the rights to provide the service in Canadian airspace, but Craig says it's unclear when that will happen. There are no plans for service on flights to Kodiak, Dillingham, Bethel, or other destinations west or north of the rail belt. The company is charging about $5 for a 90-minute flight, $10 for a 3-hour trip, and $15 for longer flights. Monthly subscriptions are also available. The Alaska Marine Highway System is taking a different approach to its Wi-Fi service.
We feel that it may be in our best interest not to charge the customer and to use this as a marketing tool.
Ferry System General Manager John Falvey says free service is still some time away. 7 of the fleet's 11 ships are already equipped with a satellite-based system offered by Radio Holland. 2 more will be set up by spring, with a final pair, the Fast Ferries, planned for a later date. But before passengers get access, the system has to handle ferry business.
One of the concerns that we do have going forward is, will we have enough broadband purchased to run the 11 ships with all the satellite communications that we need for the ships, for the reservation system, all that communication back and forth live? And will there be enough broadband to then also run hotspots for our passengers that ride the ships?
Falvey says the service contract, costing $1 million a year, may be expanded to allow for passenger use, but that will happen after it's fully set up for internal systems, and it's unclear when that work will be completed.
We're just trying to move as quickly as we can with it because, you know, we do know that the customers really like having their laptops and having the ability to get onto the internet when they're out sailing around.
The equipment and installation costs $250,000 to $300,000 per ferry, depending on its size. Falvey says funds are coming from the federal government. Alaska Airlines is not releasing its Wi-Fi installation or operating costs. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Sitka.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com.
Hello, I'm Peter Kenyon, NPR foreign correspondent and former APRN reporter. Help support APRN's news mission by joining me on October 24th for the first of the new APRN speaker series. Go to APRN.org to reserve your ticket today.
The Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation is holding its annual meetings in Fairbanks this week. The state-owned corporation's director, Mike Burns, says the fund's value has been on a roller coaster ride in recent years as the economy has gone from boom to bust and now recovery.
We touched $40 billion and then we backtracked all the way to 26-something, and we're up to, as of yesterday, 36.2. So we've made back quite a bit of it, but it was a very difficult time.
Burns says the fund survived despite the heavy financial slump of 2008, one of the five worst economic years on record in the U.S. Permanent fund investments are diversified worldwide, and Burns says fund managers did not react when the sharp downturn hit.
Probably the biggest change that we made was not change. You don't want to change at the bottom, you know, because then you make two mistakes. You wrote it to the bottom, and then you change your thing. These things do go in cycles. So your persistence and your long-term investment goals are what are really important.
Burns says Alaskans should take confidence away from the experience and be proud of the financial legacy the fund has created with state oil royalties.
I mean, to put $14.7 billion aside, pay out $18.4 in dividends, and still have $36.2 billion in a balance, I think it's an extraordinary social economic experiment that people of Alaska have done, and it's been wildly successful.
25% of state oil royalty interest goes into the permanent fund's principal. Burns says that's meant between $650 and $820 million being deposited into the fund annually over the last 4 years. He says high oil prices have elevated fund input despite declining North Slope production. Matanuska-Susitna borough voters will choose candidates for two borough assembly seats when they go to the polls next Tuesday. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more on the District 1 race, which has three candidates vying for the outgoing borough deputy mayor's chair.
The race for borough assembly districts 1 and 2 will be decided on October 5th. Current District 1 assemblywoman and deputy borough mayor Lynn Woods has reached her term limit. Woods says it's been a challenging 6 years.
Things like the technology, how much that's changed. We had to move into the 21st century, and many of our efforts were to guide the borough in that direction.
Three candidates are vying for her seat. Warren Keough is a Chicoloon resident with a long history of community service. He's a water resources specialist for the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service, soon to retire, and has been a city paramedic and firefighter. Keough's been in the Valley 30 years and has served on his local community council.
Perhaps my research and analytical skills with input from the public, I think that's what I bring forward.
District 1 covers a lot of ground, stretching from the McLaren River in the north to Eklutna in the south. Sutton and Palmer's Butte area are included as well. Keough says education and development are two key issues borough-wide.
If we look at where we've been demographically, the population 30, 40 years ago in the valley was about 10,000 people. Now we we're up to nearly 90,000 people. And the expectation is that that rate of growth is not going to diminish. So as we do grow, let's grow our economy just a bit differently. And as we grow, make sure we maintain all those special natural assets that we have.
Keogh says the borough political process needs to be more transparent. Challenger James Tapley hails from Sutton. He's retired from the construction business, and he's worried about the borough spending too much money, for instance, on buying out eroded riverfront properties or paying to preserve farmland.
What they call is preserving farmland. You want to preserve it for the future, except I shouldn't be spending our tax dollars preserving farmland, because in the near future there won't be anybody to farm it, and it's a waste of tax dollars and it produces no jobs. I mean, why would you spend millions of dollars on something that doesn't produce a job?
Tapley says his construction experience will be an assembly asset.
And I can help build this valley. Right now we have people in there that have no knowledge, and they think throwing money at things is the way to do it. And we have a lot of projects that have gone to waste and gone nowhere. Because, you know, they're just throwing money at it. They have no knowledge of what they're getting into. So we're wasting a lot of tax dollars. I've been around, you know, construction for 30 years, and I know what it takes to build something. And I know what the first thing you do when you start building something. So I think my construction experience will help build this valley and create jobs, which we really need.
Tapley says the borough puts too many restrictions on new businesses. District 1 candidate George Rauscher did not return calls for this story. Bruce Walden, who had been running for District 1, said this week that he was dropping out of the race. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Next week, the Deadliest Catch production crew will be arriving in Dutch Harbor to prepare for the 7th season of the popular Discovery Channel television series. But some of the show's biggest stars won't be greeting them. Andy and Jonathan Hillstrand of The Time Bandit and Sig Hansen of The Northwestern sent a statement to The Hollywood Reporter yesterday saying they will not be returning to the show. This announcement follows the news that Discovery Communications has filed a $3 million lawsuit against the Hillstrand brothers for failing to complete work on a special spinoff called Hill Stranded. The spinoff was supposed to follow the two crab fishermen away from their boat during the off-season. Because of the lawsuit, the brothers have decided to leave the show, and Hansen is departing with them in solidarity. Original Productions films the series, and a producer for the show says they expect to remain on their production schedule. But the exit of this trio will leave the show with few familiar faces. Phil Harris, who was captain of the Cornelia Marie, died earlier this year. His sons are expected to appear in the show this season. Liz Hillman, a spokesperson for Discovery Communications, says the company is not offering comment on the situation. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Adam Kane in Dillingham, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Sitka, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future. ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association, has been asked to administer the new temporary federal insurance program that allows individuals with a qualifying pre-existing condition and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months an opportunity to purchase health insurance. Capacity is limited, so contact an insurance broker or ACHEA immediately. More information at achia.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.